August 26th is Women's Equality Day in the United States. That's the anniversary of the day a constitutional amendment came into effect, requiring all the states to let women vote. Today on Wings, Nahani Rouse of the Jewish Women's Archive shares a documentary about the struggle for that right, and an even longer, ongoing struggle to get equal rights on the basis of sex in the U.S. Constitution, too.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
We are approaching 2020, which will be 100 years since women won the right to vote. They weren't granted the right to vote. They weren't given the right to vote. They won it, and they fought for it.
Welcome to a special edition of Can We Talk, the podcast of the Jewish Women's Archive. I'm Nahani Rouse. In this episode, we'll look back at a few key moments in the fight for women's rights over the past 100 years. We'll hear about Alice Paul's role in the women's suffrage movement. We'll talk with Eleanor Smeal, who led the fight for the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1970s and 80s. We'll examine why the ERA failed and hear about current efforts to revive it. Let's look at this story in three parts. First, the right to vote. We'll go back to the final years of the women's suffrage movement over a century ago. To do that, we visit the Belmont Paul Women's Equality National Monument in Washington, D.C. It's a historic brick house on Capitol Hill, built more than 200 years ago, around the time the nearby Capitol Dome was being finished. It used to house the National Women's Party. Now, it's a history museum, named for suffragists Alva Belmont and Alice Paul. Inside, white marble busts of suffragists guard the foyer. Susan B. Anthony's desk stands in the corner of a room, as if she just got up from writing. A few women browse exhibits.
Hi. Nice to meet you. Jennifer.
I meet Jennifer Krafchik, the deputy director of the museum.
This is a great gallery to kind of spend some time in, because that's all about the march, that panel over there.
The march Jennifer is referring to happened in 1913. Black and white photographs show crowds of people filling the streets of downtown Washington, D.C., the same streets that teemed with people during the 2017 Women's March. In 2017, women wore pink hats and carried handmade signs with diverse political messages. In 1913, the women wore long white dresses. A horse-drawn float advertised their cause.
Would you mind just reading the float?
Yeah, absolutely. We demand an amendment to the Constitution of the United States enfranchising the women of this country.
By 1913, women in 10 Western states already had voting rights in some forms, but suffragists were making slow progress at the state level. Enter Alice Paul. She was from a prominent Quaker family in New Jersey and had spent years working with suffragists in Britain. Alice Paul thought a woman's right to vote should be enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. She set her sights on a constitutional amendment and planned a march to call attention to the cause. It took place the day before President Woodrow Wilson's inauguration.
There's a very famous story about Wilson arriving at Union Station, ready to greet the crowds, and there were very few people there because they were all down on Pennsylvania Avenue watching the demonstration of women.
Five 5,000 women marched in formation. They wore their finest clothes. Some rode horses. American women had never assembled in such numbers. Newspapers all over the country covered the story. The New York Times called it an astonishing demonstration. Many women were inspired and would later join the cause. But the news wasn't all good. According to the Times, there were 500,000 spectators, and the women were beset by the crowds.
People were attacking them, throwing things at them, insulting them. The demonstration ends in sort of a riot and crowds converging on these women.
More than 100 people went to the hospital, but the women's demand for the right to vote had gained national attention. The The 1913 march was only part of the suffrage campaign. Winning the right to vote took 7 more years and an army of women who lobbied, wrote letters, gave speeches, taught each other how to organize. President Wilson didn't take the suffrages seriously, at least at first.
So in early 1917, a deputation of about 300 women goes to see him, and they are turned away. And the next day, they begin picketing the White House.
They picketed all day every day, except for Sunday, for all of 1917, and more sporadically in the following years. In April 1917, the United States entered World War I.
So at that point, this sort of benign action by these women starts to be seen more as an unpatriotic action. And so they start getting some pretty negative attention.
Their banners also became more inflammatory. They called the president Kaiser Wilson. They protested sending their sons to fight in a war they had no say over. President Wilson was speaking about fighting for equality and democracy overseas. Well, the suffragists wanted it at home, too. Tensions rose, and picketers were arrested. Many women spent time in jail. Some staged a hunger strike and were force-fed. One night, 40 women were arrested, beaten, and injured. Photographs show women staggering out of prison the next day, held up by other women. Public opinion began to shift.
You see it in a lot of the newspaper articles from the time, where it goes from condemnation of these women and unpatriotic acts and that kind of language to what is this administration allowing to happen to our nation's women?
That same month, New York became the first eastern state to grant women the right to vote. The balance tipped. Political organizing at the state level, plus the pickets and arrest in Washington, had turned the tide.
I don't think you could have had one without the other. I think both were imperative and both were critical at that time to making 1920 happen.
In 1920, Congress certified ratification of the 19th Amendment by the requisite number of states. A woman's right to vote was enshrined in the Constitution. But even that wasn't the end of the story. In practice, Jim Crow laws barred African American women and men from voting in many parts of the country. It would be another 45 years before the federal government banned racially discriminatory voting laws, and the Supreme Court has recently begun to chip away at those protections. Jennifer says people need to know the history of how women got the right to vote.
They weren't granted the right to vote. They weren't given the right to vote. They won it, and they fought for it. It's important to share this history and really encourage young women to explore their own history, good, bad, and ugly, so that they know what's at stake for women every day.
After women won the right to vote, Alice Paul reminded the suffragists that the fight for equality was just beginning. Her next move was drafting an Equal Rights Amendment. She would work for the rest of her life trying to get it passed. Alice Paul died in 1977. 40 years later, the Equal Rights Amendment is still in limbo. On Wings, you're listening to a special edition of the podcast Can We Talk? From the Jewish Women's Archive. Here's part 2 of our show, the Equal Rights Amendment.
It is not a law to allow people to marry the Eiffel Tower. It is not a law to allow bestiality.
That's Nevada State Senator Pat Spearman. In March 2017, Nevada voted to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment, 95 years after it was first introduced to Congress.
The Equal Rights Amendment, or the ERA, is about equality for all citizens and placing that guarantee in our Constitution. Nothing more.
In 1972, Congress passed the Equal Rights Amendment. President Nixon signed it. But 38 states would need to ratify, and Congress had taken the unusual step of imposing a time limit. For a while, it looked like the ERA might sail through the process. But by the 1982 deadline, the ERA was still 3 states shy. The recent Nevada vote brings that down to 2, but Congress will still have to lift the deadline. And there's plenty of opposition, like this, from Nevada State Senator Joe Hardy.
Surely we must admit to ourselves that there is a difference between the sexes. These differences cannot be negated by a law nor a constitutional amendment. I will be voting for families, for children, for celebrating the differences of our God-given genders, and for a more stable society with safeguards for women and children.
This family values argument has been used against the Equal Rights Amendment since it was first introduced to Congress in 1923. Conservatives have maligned the ERA in all kinds of ways. That's why Senator Spearman defended it so vigorously.
It is not a law that allows unfettered abortions. It is not a law that negates Social Security benefits for spouses. It is not a law that prevents men from opening doors for women.
Here's what the amendment does say. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. That's it. The whole thing. Do we still need a statement as simple as this? What does the U.S. Constitution say about gender equality? To find out what Americans know about this, I head to Constitution Avenue and the National Mall.
What sign is on to cross Constitution Northwest?
Hi, excuse me. I produce a podcast and I'm doing a survey. Do you mind if I ask you one question? Does the U.S. Constitution guarantee women equal rights?
No.
Yes.
No. It has some rights, but not fully equal rights.
Yes. Because it makes no difference between human beings, men or women.
I think that it says every man, so I assume that includes women as well.
No, no, sorry, you can ask my husband.
Do we have an Equal Rights Amendment in the Constitution?
Yes, we do. Yes, long time ago.
I remember the Equal Rights Amendment fight, but it wasn't passed at that time, I don't think.
Interesting, I thought it was.
There's a lot of confusion out there about women's constitutional rights. Surveys show that around 90% of Americans support an Equal Rights Amendment, and most people mistakenly think it's already part of the Constitution. That misunderstanding is only part of the uphill battle advocates face. Our next stop is an office on K Street in downtown D.C.
Yes,
hi. I'm Bettina. So nice to meet you.
Bettina Hager is the director of the Equal Rights Amendment Coalition. She's the coalition's one full-time staff member. Bettina grew up with a feminist mom and a strong sense of justice, but she was born in the 1980s, after the deadline for ratifying the ERA had passed.
So I had zero awareness of the Equal Rights Amendment growing up. Zero.
But she was aware of discrimination and personally experienced sexual harassment. She took college courses that helped her see gender discrimination as systemic. Now, she thinks the Equal Rights Amendment has the potential to restart a national conversation about equality.
And that conversation is important. You know, I've spoken to young women who feel that that conversation hasn't really been in their life. I think that an Equal Rights Amendment, it allows women to look at how the issues that we face are linked together.
Young women, Bettina says, are used to thinking about their rights in a piecemeal way. Reproductive rights, equal pay, and the right to a safe campus environment.
None of these issues are truly separate, and it's not the fault of the women's movement at all that we have to look at it separately, but you can't get anything done without having a strong focus.
Bettina thinks a push to finally ratify the Equal Rights Amendment could help provide that focus, and she thinks it's critical. She points out that every constitution adopted since World War II has some form of an Equal Rights Amendment, including constitutions the U.S. has had a hand in drafting.
We're not doing anything that is groundbreaking. We're doing something to catch up to the vast majority of countries and that we have insisted other countries do. In Iraq and Afghanistan, we insisted that they put it in.
And in those other countries, though, has it actually on the ground helped women? Like, it may be there on paper.
You know, I think that it depends on how seriously you take your constitution. And America takes the constitution very seriously. Whether or not I'm saying that another country is more advanced in women's rights than ours, I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that they can, in their fight to advance women's rights, point to a legal fundamental document. And we don't have that.
When the Equal Rights Amendment was first introduced, conservatives weren't the only ones against it. Organized labor was also opposed, including working-class suffragists. They worried it would nullify hard-won protections for female workers. The ERA languished for decades, but things began to change in the 1960s. As the civil rights movement took center stage, The women's movement was reinvigorated. Many women, like Eleanor Smeal, came to feminism through their involvement in civil rights. Ellie Smeal fought segregation during her college years at Duke.
And then when I came out of school, if you didn't notice you were being discriminated against, if you're a woman, you weren't paying attention.
In law schools and medical schools, there were tiny quotas for women, 3 or 8%. Women were routinely passed over for promotions, and want ads might call for male help or female help.
I didn't like racial discrimination. I don't like sex discrimination. I don't like LGBTQ discrimination. I just don't like treating people unfairly. It's all the same thing.
Ellie Smeal is president of the Feminist Majority Foundation, which advocates for women's equality around the world. She's been an activist most of her life. In the late 1970s and again during the 80s, she was president of NOW, the National Organization for Women. NOW was leading the charge for the ERA. In 1971, Ellie came to Washington for a demonstration. It was a silent vigil on the steps of the Senate.
So we stayed all day on this crazy silent vigil, which I have to say it's the last one I've ever participated in because I cannot stand being silent that long.
After the vigil, they went to a historic brick house not far from the Capitol. Nowadays, it's the Belmont Paul Women's Equality National Monument, where we stopped in the first part of the show. In the 70s, it was the headquarters of the National Women's Party. A small group of elderly suffragists were living there.
It was all dark. And I said, you know, I think we're too late. But the others said, no, no, no. We just can't see. There might be people in there. They told us to come here. Anyway, they kept pounding on the door.
They knocked and knocked until finally a small elderly woman wearing a nightgown cracked the door open.
I turned to my friend and I said, oh, my God. I said, we've woken them up. I mean, this is crazy. And she said, oh, no, no. And then the woman said, are you the NOW woman? And we said, yes.
And the woman who opened the door in her nightgown was 85-year-old Alice Paul, the leader of the women's suffrage movement from the 19-teens.
And she flings open the door, grabs from the wall a bell, starts ringing the bell and saying, they've come, they've come, they've come. And she goes up this flight of stairs, yelling, they've come. And all these other little older women come. And I'm looking at my friend. I'm saying, see what you've done. You've woke these people up. This is crazy. And she said, Ellie, you'd be excited, too, if you waited 50 years for reinforcements.
Those reinforcements came, bringing with them mass demonstrations, sit-ins, lobbying. Public opinion seemed to be shifting. In 1972, the Equal Rights Amendment passed both houses of Congress. President Nixon signed it.
All of us so happy it had passed. And in those days, we didn't think we'd ever get defeated on anything. We didn't know defeat. We were marching forward.
After Congress passed the Equal Rights Amendment, Ellie and her colleagues went to see Alice Paul again. After all, she had been the one to introduce the amendment 50 years before. But Alice Paul wasn't celebrating.
She's sitting at Susan B. Anthony's desk in that room, and she's crying.
Congress had put a time limit on ratification.
And she thought it was a trick.
Congress could look good for passing the amendment, but Alice Paul thought some states would just run the clock.
She's a smart woman, dedicated, and with all of her faculties.
And she was right.
And she was right.
You're listening to Can We Talk, the podcast of the Jewish Women's Archive. In the third and final segment of the show, we'll talk about what happened to the Equal Rights Amendment and where it is today. In the mid-1970s, just as ratification seemed within reach, opposition to the ERA got organized. Its public persona was Phyllis Schlafly. She was a conservative lawyer, writer, and activist who died in 2016. Here she is in a 1973 interview.
ERA won't give women anything which they haven't already got or have a way of getting. But on the other hand, it will take away from women some of the most important rights and benefits and exemptions we now have.
What would be an example of that?
Well, a great glaring example on which there is full agreement between both the proponents and the opponents is the matter of the draft.
The Vietnam draft had ended by then, but its shadow lingered. Ellie Smeal says, for the most part, the women's movement was in favor of including women in a draft, though they opposed the Vietnam War. Phyllis Schlafly also called the amendment an assault on the family.
They want to give the homosexuals and the lesbians the same dignity as husbands and wives.
Gay marriage? Women in combat? These things have become a reality without the Equal Rights Amendment. But Schlafly had many arguments against the ERA. She claimed it would do away with separate bathrooms for men and women, Social Security benefits for wives, and alimony payments. As for workplace discrimination, Schlafly said that women didn't want the higher-paying jobs. Here she is in a 1982 speech.
Most women like the nice, inside, sit-down jobs in an air-conditioned office. And that is the trade-off women take in terms of pay.
Schlafly would not acknowledge that women were systematically paid less for the same work and looked over for promotions. If women made less than men, it showed their priorities were in the right place. Feminists, she said, were degrading women who stayed at home raising children.
I get fed up with the women's liberationists running down motherhood and saying that it's a menial, degrading career, and that the home is a prison from which women should be liberated and brought out into this wonderful workforce.
Schlafly's message resonated with many women and men. She neglected to share the fact that she herself was a working mother with a law degree. Part of her shtick was showing up with homemade bread and fresh pies for legislators. Schlafly liked to say that she and her Stop ERA ladies were up against Hollywood celebrities, the liberal media, and the pushy women's organizations.
But a little band of unflappable Stop ERA ladies in red, headquartered in my kitchen on the bluffs of the Mississippi River in Alton, Illinois, set out to challenge all the big guns of modern politics.
Presidents Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and Jimmy Carter supported the Equal Rights Amendment. But in 1980, the Republican Party, with Ronald Reagan in the lead, repositioned itself as the party of conservative family values, against abortion, against homosexuality, and against the Equal Rights Amendment. The 1982 deadline for ratification came and went. Schlafly and her Stop ERA ladies were credited with helping to derail the ERA.
And the big lesson we learn from this is that in the marvelous process of self-government given to us by our founding fathers, it is possible for the people to defeat the entire political and media establishment and to win despite incredible odds.
She claimed to have led a grassroots campaign, but Ellie Smeal says Schlafly was a smokescreen to make it look like a fight among women.
I went to every state myself. I knew who the lobbyists were. The lobbyists were business guys. We had massive lobbyists against us, especially the insurance companies.
That's because health insurance companies charged women more for coverage. And, by the way, that practice was outlawed by the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare. Back in the 1970s, businesses were protecting their bottom lines. By then, women made up more than a third of the workforce.
Who benefits from paying women, adult women, less but corporate America? So you had the National Association of Manufacturers against us. You had the Chambers of Commerce against us. You had business interests against us.
Ellie says the insurance companies even funded Schlafly's organization, the Eagle Forum.
I come back to money because I do believe that if you didn't make money off of race and sex discrimination and immigrant status, we wouldn't probably have this much discrimination.
But it's not just economic inequality. Ellie has also spent her life combating violence against women, working for equal access to education and reproductive rights. She says we need an Equal Rights Amendment because legislation is vulnerable, not to mention difficult to pass. The question is, how would the Equal Rights Amendment help?
The laws are not on our side and they're not strong enough. I am sick to death of all the exceptions. We can't win this. Statute by statute, law by law, state by state. You can't do this way. We need a far stronger commitment.
Most feminists agree that our society needs a stronger commitment to equality. But some don't think the Equal Rights Amendment is the way to get there. Some women I spoke to, even a few who campaigned for the ERA in the 1970s, now think it's a distraction from more pressing issues. They would rather see resources devoted directly to safeguarding reproductive rights, working for racial justice, combating sexual violence. Some legal experts also don't think an Equal Rights Amendment is necessary. They argue that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment is now commonly interpreted to include equal protection for women. But not everyone reads it that way. Here's the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia speaking in a forum at the University of California.
Certainly, the Constitution does not require sexual discrimination on the basis of sex. The only issue is whether it prohibits it. It doesn't.
What he means is that lawmakers in 1866 did not intend the 14th Amendment to apply to women, and therefore it doesn't. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg does think the Equal Protection Clause applies to women, but she also thinks the Constitution should be stronger when it comes to gender equality.
If I could choose an amendment to add to this Constitution, it would be the Equal Rights Amendment.
This is Justice Ginsburg speaking to an audience at the National Press Club in 2014.
It means that women are people equal in stature before the law. That principle belongs in our Constitution. I would like my granddaughters, when they pick up the Constitution, to see that notion that women and men are persons of equal stature. I'd like them to see that that is a basic principle of our society.
But how do we get there? Even though the Equal Rights Amendment was never ratified, the campaign in the 1970s certainly helped move our legal system forward. Now, the fight to revive the ERA is just one aspect of a reawakening feminist movement. Ellie Smeal knows as well as anyone that social change is not linear. It takes continuous action, flexibility, and optimism.
There is no manual, no blueprint to how to get to equality. You just got to do it. And if you see an injustice, you got to stand up. Don't think if it's the most important thing to do or the least important. You never know when victory is around the corner.
The story of the Equal Rights Amendment spans nearly a century. Four generations of women fighting for equality, each pushing the bar a little higher. This story is a production of Can We Talk, the podcast of the Jewish Women's Archive. You can hear more stories about courageous women changemakers on our website at jwa.org/canwetalk. You can also subscribe for free via iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever else you find your podcasts. Can We Talk is produced by me, Nahani Rouse, and Judith Rosenbaum, the Executive Director of the Jewish Women's Archive. Ibi Caputo edits our scripts. Our theme music is by Girls in Trouble. In this episode, you also heard a 1914 suffrage march by Zena Hahn and a 1918 recording of Johnny Get Your Gun. Special thanks to Bobby Francis, Jen Dieterich, Barbara Dobkin, and Jeanette Dean. For Can We Talk, this is Nahani Rouse. Join us again at jwa.org/canwetalk.
To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. Thanks to all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.